Welcome to Podcasting Them Softly series for your eyes only on the James Bond films. This is Tom Zielinski, and today the most excellent Frank Mengarelli, RG, and me welcome. Yes, hey, how you doing, Frank? And me welcome special guest podcaster Mac Cherry to join us in discussing the 13th Bond film, Octopussy. Mac is a very passionate and knowledgeable aficionado of cinema and has always been especially keen on the 007 series. So welcome, Mac. He currently lives in London, though lived for a spell in Los Angeles. And though I haven't seen him in a couple of years, I consider him one of the best, my best friends in the world. But he's really here for his spot-on perspectives and wit about the Bond series. Welcome, Mac. How you doing?
Thank you very much. And thank you, Frank and Z. And I know I call you Z. That's because we've known each other for many, many years, and you'll always be a Z to me. I'm very excited and nervous and everything else. So let's have some fun.
Absolutely. And I've known Mac via the internet, via the James Bond connection, for about 25 years via the old Usenet group, Alt Fan James Bond, which has now got a what's the word? It's on Facebook. If you look it up, Facebook Alt Fan James Bond. It's a great group. I'm an administrator. I was going to say it's got a rendition, but that's not the right word.
It's migrated.
It's migrated. Thank you. Anyway, I've known Mac for a long time via the internet. We've met many times in real life. He's one of my best friends in the world, one of the smartest guys I know, and he knows his shit about cinema. So I'm really excited to hear his perspectives on James Bond and Octopussy. Released in 1983, Octopussy is the sixth that starred Roger Moore as Bond and the second directed by John Glenn. Interestingly, Sean Connery's Never Say Never Again was released in the same year. So sometimes 1983 was known as the Battle of the Bonds. We will have a few minutes towards the end to discuss some developments regarding Bond 25, but let's get into it, Frank. Let's talk about Octopussy. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Mac. It's a pleasure to meet you. It's good to be here with you guys. I'm not on the Z level with Tom, so I just, you're good people if you get to the Z level with Tom, so that's awesome. I'm glad to know that, but yeah, I'm excited you're here to discuss this. It's always fun when we have a third perspective discussing a Bond film, because we have reached the era of Bond where Tom and I differ a little bit, because I'm a Roger Moore guy through and through, kind of like, Tom's a Connery guy.
My suspicion, Frank, is that I've been railroaded into this. I suspect that Z has hauled me on to talk about Octopussy because he expects me to mount some Johnny Cochran-type defense of the movie where I'm going to produce the glove that will actually change his entire opinion of this movie. But I'm not here to praise Octopussy. I'm here to sort of semi-bury it as well, but
all right,
with care and affection.
Okay, so
no,
basically
it.
It's up to me then.
Not at all.
Okay, good.
I'll defend it with you, but not as steadfastly as yourself.
Okay.
Frank.
So there's one thing I wanted to lead with too that's very important. I know my dad is a faithful listener of our James Bond series because my dad is a huge proponent of why I love Bond, and this is his favorite Bond movie. So I know he's going to be excited for this podcast.
Oh, great!
So
cool. What is your dad's name?
My dad is Harold. He goes by Harry. Harold. So Harry, this is for you, Pops.
Yes,
this is for you, Harry.
So all right, so let's dive into Octopussy. So here's the thing with me and Octopussy, because I'm going to make it about me for a second. Now, as you guys are well aware,
per usual,
exactly. Z hogs the mic often, so I got to get a word in. I'm just kidding.
I stumble over myself all the time. No,
so
I get it.
With this movie, this is one of the Moore ones I have probably seen the least. And while I do enjoy it, it's not my favorite Moore. But there are things that I love about it. Louis Jourdan is amazing.
I'm with you, Frank. I'm with you. Yeah, there are things about it I think as well that there are a lot of nuggets in there, but there's also some not so great stuff. But yeah, Louis Jourdan is fantastic in this movie. Some of the reaction shots are just amazing. The breaking of the Fabergé egg where, you know, that solves the mystery of whether or not it's the fake or the real egg, because people get confused and things like that. But yeah, I think he's terrific in that. The one thing about Lou Jourdain that I always remember is he was in a BBC adaptation of Dracula. I think late 70s, and he was amazing in it. And it's sort of the thing that always turned me on to him. I remember it vividly as a kid. And so it was great seeing him in Octopussy. I thought he was great fun. Good value for money.
I love that you brought up the reaction shots, because that is something I rewatched it again last night. And that's something that I think is very potent in the film. And I think he does it very well. And during the auction scene at the head of the film, especially when they're dueling it out over the egg. And I love his reaction shots in that. And I love how he carries himself.
It's one of the best scenes in the movie, the auction scene. It's very Fleming-esque, you know, it really is. I mean, it's, you know, Property of a Lady, and also the palming of the egg is marvelous. It's total Ian Fleming, you know. That's one of the black gloves that I'll throw down to Z in the defense of the movie.
Well, speaking of Fleming, I recently reread Octopussy, the short story that Fleming wrote and published in 1966. And I don't know, Frank, if you've read any of the short stories or all of them, but it's really well done. This one's highly recommended. He's a really wonderful writer, and especially his descriptions of it's set in Jamaica largely or mostly or all of it. But his descriptions of undersea life and swimming and snorkeling are just wonderful. James Bond actually has a very small role. It's about what's his name? Dexter Smythe, who actually, just to give you some background, I'd like to get Mac's perspective as well. He plays basically a smuggler, was in the British Secret Service during the war, and basically stole and smuggled some gold bars that were possession of the Nazis. And one of the character actually who he, spoiler, that he killed to get these Nazi gold bars was a character named Oberhauser. And if you have seen the film Spectre, that character is referenced as the Blofeld and Bond father figure or father. And the reason, and so there's some revenge issue or perspective there in the short story very much. And that Bond took this assignment to approach Smythe in Jamaica and tell him, hey, we found Oberhauser's body 20 years ago or whatever it was, would have been 20 years, I suppose. And that he was Bond's father figure at one point, so he's really pissed at Dexter Smythe for assassinating him, for killing him. And he gives the option, because they found out that he killed Oberhauser, that Smythe killed Oberhauser, that he stole this gold, so he was going to be arrested, court-martialed, all this. And Bond basically gives him the option to commit suicide, and that is also used somewhat in the film.
Yeah.
Call.
So, yeah, it's Octopussy's father, isn't it, in the movie? Yeah.
That's interesting. So there's more of a connection than just in name only with Spectre, then.
Correct. No, Oberhauser also is a mountaineer, if I remember
exactly.
In the short story as well, and taught Bond to ski.
Correct.
Yeah. Awesome. That's very cool.
It is cool. It's a really good short story. I'd recommend it. What do you think of the literary work, Mac? Do you like the short story? Are you a fan of Fleming short stories in general?
Some of them, certainly, yeah. I haven't actually read the Octopussy short story for quite some time, but that's also in because that's in the collection with the Living Daylights as well, isn't it?
Correct.
I think, yeah. And, the one thing that I think we've always loved as Bond fans from way back on AFJB days is that when the movies return to the books, even little bits such as that, it always gives a tickle, but also
it elevates the film.
Yeah, it does. I don't know whether that's sort of you know, loyalty to Fleming or whatever, but it certainly does bring something to it. And Oberhauser, of course, was the mountaineer in the story as well.
Yeah. Correct.
Was it Hannes Oberhauser in the story, and Franz in the movie?
Franz is the son, right?
Franz, yes, is Blofeld.
I don't know if they say the first name of the dad. I imagine they do.
Right.
They have. Right. I would imagine they do. Mm. I need to watch that again. It's been a little bit since I watched
it. I'm looking up characters online. I'll know in a moment. Just keep talking, though, boys. I'll let you know.
Okay, so the other point I kind of wanted to bring up, or I guess lead with, other than Louis Jordan, is while this probably isn't my favorite Moore performance as James Bond, I still love him, though. But
he's looking pretty old.
He does, not as old as the next one, which we'll get to, but he's looking a little old, which is fine. But I think the villains are great in this. Other than Louis Jordan, which we spoke about, I love Stephen Burkoff Orlov. I mean, Stephen Burkoff's great in everything, but it's always a treat when you get to see an actor like that get like a showy turn in a Bond movie.
A little bit
movie.
Over the top.
Yeah, right. There's
a hook, and he's so far off it, it's unbelievable. But he works for a Bond movie. I mean, he's chewing scenery, and there's some, you know, marvelous scenery
exactly,
in the movie. That incredible control room where he launches into that tirade and everything else, you know, that war room,
we're years into the Cold War. So, of course, you know, the Bond movie's going to have the Russian that wants to start World War III.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And then the other aspect that I love are the twins. I think the twins are so much fun in this movie.
The knife guys?
Yes. Twin 1 and Twin 2, as they're credited.
The Meyer brothers.
I didn't realize that either. I thought maybe they'd have a name, but I'm on IMDb right now. And then it's David Meyer and Anthony Meyer is Twin 1, Twin 2. And I'm like, okay,
hang on.
Fun.
In the movies, they have a name, because I think when the living one has Bond pinned down and about to kill him, he says, this is for my... I'm sure he says this is for Grishka or something like that. And,
okay.
And
no, he says this is for Twin number 1.
Yeah.
Okay, and then
sorry.
Gobinda.
Oh yes.
Gobinda is fun.
He's a big, strong, mute, dummy guy, total odd job ripoff, even to the extent of crushing ice.
Yeah. Just crushing the dice. Yeah.
I think it works. I think he's fun. I think he's effective.
Hey, how about at the end on the airplane he goes, go out there and get them? And yeah, okay. Sure, yeah. I'll be right there.
That's my dad's favorite scene, and that's what my dad always quotes to me.
Does he laugh though?
Yeah.
Okay.
Loves it. So I like those guys. Maybe not Gobinda as much as the twins, Orlov. I think Orlov, they do it right, with the two, I guess, main villains or head villains. You got the stoic, reserved, underplayed Kamal Khan.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the Rod Steiger-esque over-the-top Orlov, right? And I've just watched a couple Rod Steiger movies recently, so that's why I was able... That's the connection. Usually I say Eric Roberts over-the-top, but that's not applicable here because it's a good performance. But even though I love the shit out of Eric Roberts, but still... So Stephen Burkoff. I mean, what do you think of the twins? I know you liked Mac. I know you dig Orlov like I do. What do you think about the twins?
I can take or leave the twins. Okay. They don't. I mean, obviously they perform a function in the movie, but they don't sort of rock my world the way Burkoff does. You know, I just remember the way he says decadent in the West is decadent.
Oh yes.
You know, it's just marvelous, you know, and you're quite right, Frank, when you say that obviously Kamal Khan is the smooth, urbane, cool version. And you know, it's interesting because if you look at the three of them, it's like Orlov is all about war. And Kamal Khan is about greed. An Octopussy, well, I guess the thrill. I don't know. I don't know what she gets out of the smuggling, but it's interesting that's why they're actually carrying out the plot as well, which is interesting enough because Frederick Forsyth liked it enough to use it for the Fourth Protocol.
Yeah, he did, didn't he? Which is a superior film, by the way.
Mm.
I just looked it up just as an aside. It was Hans in the in the short story and its friends, and then now in the movie Spectre.
Okay. Okay.
But go ahead.
No, I was just wondering if twin one and twin two mysteries.
Yeah, that's the next. That's the next one we have to. Wikipedia, Surrey.
I've got it up here. Let's see. It says twin one and twin two in IMDb.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking at right now. Okay. Usually IMDb is pretty good about names, even if there's like an alternate name for the character.
I can't believe a Bond fan hasn't done it. Yeah.
And looking at the IMDb, I'm glad that I saw Penelope Smallbone because of I think it was like the second time I rewatched it in preparation and then really noticed it again last night. It's just like unnecessary.
Yeah.
And they're really pointing out that Moneypenny is getting old as shit.
Yeah. Yes.
Which, you know, she looks older and that's fine, but I love the continuity. But Miss Smallbone never comes back. And it's like, were you guys trying to introduce her as the next Moneypenny?
Yeah, because she's so full of personality in the movie. So I can't, right. You know, I just can't believe they didn't get her back. Well, I mean, she just lights up the screen.
Michaela Clavell is her name, and her picture on IMDb is holding the flowers.
Yeah.
The scene, and then the other photo of her on IMDb is a three shot of her, Roger Moore, and Lois Maxwell. So she didn't really do too much after this. So Miss Smallbone never.
And then in the next film, they introduce another character to potentially replace Moneypenny.
Who is she? Because she was only in some TV show, a TV short, and then Octopussy. Those are the only credits she has. Mm. So
she must have known someone.
Yes.
I'm still looking up Twin 1 and 2. You guys.
Okay, guys.
It's Grishka. It's Grishka.
I knew it.
He knew it. You called it.
It was Mishka and Grishka. Yeah, I called it.
Grishka.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So let's address Maude Adams then, because this is the first time they ever brought back the same actor to play a different character. A prominent character.
Correction. Well,
showy character that's like on the poster, and we're going to advertise that Maude Adams is back in another Bond movie. You know what I mean?
Aside from the MI6 people.
Correct. And Joe Don Baker being in The Living Daylights and then playing something completely new in Goldeneye. I mean, I love Joe Don Baker, but like, you're not going to put that in a trailer.
No.
You know what I mean? It's not going to be advertised. Yeah. But Maude Adams is huge.
Walking tall. In the teaser trailer, didn't she actually introduce the teaser trailer for Octopussy? She actually says, she does the introduction. I'm pretty certain she does. Into I'm Octopussy
I think I do remember that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's something like that. So yeah, she's front and center, and actually she's really her romance with Bond is utterly convincing, and with Roger, and they spark off each other. So it's, you know, I'd imagine that, you know, Roger probably had some influence on her coming back as well, because
I would think.
Yeah, you know.
But I think it's kind of interesting, right? Because Bond usually. The movies usually use the different actresses. So I just thought this was interesting that she was brought back after being a prominent role in an earlier Moore film to being the title character.
Yeah.
That isn't in it as much as you probably would think she would be. Right?
Yeah.
I think that's another great thing that they utilize with in this film too, is you don't see her often. Which I like.
Yeah, that's how she's introduced, isn't she? Feeding the octopus, and you just hear her voice initially.
Mm-hmm. She's like Blofeld, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You don't know which side she's on and so on. That's right. That's true.
You know, that's
she might be the bad person or whatever, you know, the villain or what,
right.
Whatever you might
but
think.
But just
so.
even like the design thematically of how she's used. I think it's akin to Blofeld, which I think is fun.
Sure.
Which is a fun gimmick that works in the Bond movies, and then it's just like a tongue-in-cheek, overly self-aware that this is, you know, we brought Maude Adams back. Maybe I'm making too big of a deal out of it, but I always thought that was a very cool and interesting aspect.
Well, one of the actresses actually heavily linked with the Octopussy role was Sybil Danning, believe it or not.
I don't believe it. Seriously?
No, well, there you go. Sybil.
I listened to the Octopussy... tracks, the commentary tracks this time. And they did mention that they were interviewing or auditioning many actresses for the Octopussy role, and nobody seemed to work. And Cubby saw Maude Adams socially, and he said he decided it was her. That's what I understand. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan. I mean, she always leaves me cold. She's not bad in this film. And I do agree with the point made earlier that the romance between she and Bond is believable. She does play Dexter Smythe's. Is that character mentioned in the film? I forget. But from the short story, she's playing his daughter, the smuggler. And she even makes the reference. She goes, that Bond allowed him, Dexter Smythe, to commit suicide instead of being arrested and disgraced and such. And I think she says something along the lines of, I appreciate that, or we appreciate that. It means a lot. Wasn't there a line, something along those lines? Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a reference to the short story, which I thought was very, very cool.
Yeah. And also it sets up her reversal, her allegiance to Bond later in the movie as well, because not only does she fall in love with him, but she starts out with an obligation to him for the way he treated her father, I guess.
I would agree with that. Now, I think she carried on the point. I think you said, Mac, was why was she, what was her motivation of being a smuggler? I think she was basically carrying on her father's legacy to an extent. But then the whole circus thing, I guess, just as a cover for the smuggling operation. I don't know. How come smugglers are always depicted in the Bond series and films and even the novels as you know, they're not bad guys. They're
I always think like the archetypal view of a smuggler is they're the
rogue?
Anti-hero. They're the antagonist protagonist. I'll give you two examples. They're both Han Solo.
Yeah.
The other smuggler that comes to mind, and this is a ridiculous comparison, but I'm going to roll with it, is Glenn Frey in Miami Vice.
Right.
And the only reason is because Smuggler's Blues.
Smuggler's Blues.
It's a great song.
I can take all the Miami Vice references you can throw
at me. All right. Well, that is Jimmy. What the hell is his name? It's like Jimmy something, and he was like in the Vietnam pilot, and then he helps him out. That episode is fantastic.
Uh-huh.
That episode is great. I love that episode. But yeah, I think smugglers are kind of...
There's a romantic element.
Exactly. And bad things. Right?
Even Columbo in For Your Eyes Only. I guess Draco in Honor Majesty's Secret Service was a smuggler.
That's a great observation.
You know, they're good guys.
Yeah.
They're making money on the side. They leave them alone.
Right.
The honorable guys, deep down.
Honorable.
That's what it is.
Honor among thieves.
When it comes down to it, they do the right thing.
Yes.
Yes.
Honorable, like you said. But this film has, to me, might have been surpassed now since, but the most forgettable Bond theme. I'm not a really Coolidge fan. It's a nice enough song. But it's not a Bond theme. It's really poor, in my opinion, for a Bond theme.
It's funny you mention that, because I was going to bring that up earlier, and then I just thought about something that I really love about this film, and Roger Moore in particular, which we'll get to. And then I thought about the theme as you were talking about it. And I'll tell you what, man. Like, I love all the Bond themes, and even some of the ones that aren't great, I love. But, like, there's nothing really about this one that I can think of off the top of my head. Even the credit sequence.
Right.
I find underwhelming. I find the titles, everything about it, it's just like, we just had For Your Eyes Only, man.
It's derivative. It's uninspiring. It's boring.
It's uninspired. It is uninspired.
Maurice Binder, I love you, but that was.
I agree.
That was a weaker effort.
I agree, Mac. Do you want to come in and fight for it?
No, I don't want to defend it at all. No, but I will say though that it did provide the movie with the strap line, all time high, because that was used in the posters, which is unusual. But that's by no means actually defending this easy listening, middle of the road song that I agree with Z. It's pretty forgettable, really, as far as the Bond songs go.
It was in that Mark, what's his name? He sang it. It's a romantic comedy from a couple years ago. The guy from Entourage, what's his name? Mark whatever? Mark? Mark Wahlberg. He sings All Time High. It's
like a Ted movie.
Yeah, it sounds like
it was Ted, of course. Yeah, Ted.
That's funny. I have to I don't really like Ted. Didn't see the second one. But the fact he sings All Time High makes me want to watch the movie. I don't like Mark Wahlberg either. So, but if he ever listens to the podcast, I love him and I'd love to interview him. But other than that, I'm just oversaturated by Mark Wahlberg, I guess. Okay, he's great in Boogie Nights, man. He'll never have a better performance than Boogie Nights.
I was flipping by it late at night, and I started 10 minutes earlier, so I rewound it all the way, and I watched the whole thing at like 2 in the morning.
That movie is incredible.
It is incredible.
Mac, quick thoughts on Boogie Nights.
Oh, Boogie Nights. I thought we were still talking about Ted. I was thinking about, you know, any movie that has Sam Jones as Flash Gordon in gets a little bit of
Yeah, I agree.
Gets a little bit of love. Anyway, Boogie Nights is incredible. Boogie Nights, you know, is amazing. You know, count the Scorsese camera shots, but I love it.
Oh, I know. It's like the opening to the movie is like I Am Cuba meets the
Meets Goodfellas.
It's insane. All right, so what I do love.
Go ahead. No, you.
No,
you first.
I was gonna say something about Bond, unless you wanted to say anything about Boogie Nights.
No, nothing about Boogie.
Okay. Nothing about Boogie. All right, so the thing I do love about the film is we get the White Tux Roger Moore, finally, and we get him playing cards.
Backgammon.
Backgammon.
Oh, you're correct. We get him playing backgammon. Loaded dice. That's a great scene.
It's right out of Goldfinger, too, though.
Yeah, but I'm with
That's
Frank.
Fine.
The best scene is the best thing, in that movie is Roger's reaction when he throws the dice. He doesn't even look at the dice. He just lucky sixes. Fancy that. And he just, you know, it's just Roger in his element.
Let's hold this and talk about this for a sec. All right, and that is the more James Bond that I absolutely love. And it's the only time James Bond has been like that because it's been Roger Moore playing that character. I mean, maybe Daniel Craig, am I saying it right, can do
no.
it.
No.
Craig.
It's Craig.
Yeah.
So I'm American. Yeah. Sorry, guys, but Daniel Craig. So, I mean, maybe he could do it, but, like, I don't see Sean Connery doing that. I mean, I don't know about, you know, Lazenby, Dalton. That's Roger Moore, James Bond to me.
Brosnan could do it, too.
That's fair. So Pierce Brosnan and then Moore. But I've always said that, like, I feel like the Roger Moore Bond influenced both those Bonds because, I mean, he had to, right? Sure. But anyway, sure. But that's Roger Moore, James Bond, and that's what I love about Roger Moore, James Bond.
The interesting thing, to put forward a Fleming-esque argument for Roger... Roger Moore's Bond is the only Bond that actually genuinely convinced me he was a gourmand. It's when he's talking about the in If Your Eyes Only, there's a bit where he's talking about the wine and it's too severe for his palate or something. He's the only one that could get away with that. And yet it's something that you'd expect of Bond, you know, being the food lover that he is. So, yeah, I'd go along with that.
Right.
Definitely.
It's a different. Someone from a different class structure playing Bond. That's what it feels like. Bond feels elevated.
I agree. And he is a gourmand. And I'm gonna give you that point, Mac. I think you are correct. He did convincingly portray that aspect of the character. At the same time, I'm going to throw this at you. A couple things that came at me as I was watching the film again. Here's Roger Moore's take on James Bond in the pre-title sequence. And it just happened in Moonraker 2. He was a prisoner basically in that open air truck, and then that girl with the big cleavage drives by, and he gives the guard, hey, you know, have a look.
The legs, yeah.
He gives the wink. It's like, you know, and the same thing happened in the ambulance with Holly Goodhead in Moonraker, and it's like, oh, it's so sleazy. And then in the Q sequence, he's doing that camera thing, he's zooming in on the cleavage. It's like, what is that all about?
That's extreme.
The Q scene in this film is the worst.
Yeah, but Roger Moore is the ladies' man, James Bond.
Okay. But you know what? I love the Q character. I love the gadgets. I do. I love the gadgets. But those gadgets that were introduced in this film had no practical application.
Let me just also
none. Zero.
Jesus. We're entering the 80s of American cinema. Right? Okay. Yeah. So everything is changing. And do you know what I think of when I think of the watch and the cleavage shot? It's like Duran Duran, MTV, like that's the type of thing that happens. That's what I think about in the 80s sometimes, and I think that's a hallmark of the 80s. Now, does anyone see what I'm saying here? I think
this I get it, but it's right. Not James Bond.
I agree that at times James Bond is a wonderful reflection of the current culture in America or the world. I love that about certain, like Live and Let Die. I think it's awesome. I love it. I love the incorporation of blaxploitation. Amazing. I know we talked about that before. And then there's times where it's like James Bond in space is Han Solo floating around with a laser gun. Doesn't really work for me, even though I like the set piece and it's fun. And I think that there's times when it's just like, you know, you can tell by watching the James Bond movie, the era it's set in, right? You watch this movie, you're like, it's 80s.
Yeah, this is a Seymour Goldfarb Jr. moment. It's like more Cannonball Run than James Bond. You know, it's like
those portions, you mean?
Yeah, the zooming in on the cleavage and everything else. It's like something, you know, you almost expect to hear Burt Reynolds in the background. On. You know, it's just one of those moments, you know. I'm with Z on that one, Frank. I'm sort of in the middle here.
Don't get me wrong. It's not something I love about the movie. Or it's like, I'm going to watch Octopussy because I want to see the cleavage shot on the Casio or whatever. It's not a Casio. What is it? That's exactly what it is. So it's like, that's what I want to see. And it's like, that's not it. It's like when I watch Octopussy, I want to see the dice get crushed in the hand. And I want to see them playing the game, and I want to see the buzzsaw.
And you want to see Christina Weyburn. Oh, my.
Yes, she's yep. So that's a good transition. Delicious. What do you think about her, Tom?
A lot of forehead, but she's a very beautiful woman.
Oh, my God.
I hope she's not listening. Christina, severe apologies. Yeah. I cannot criticize.
But
you
amazing.
Are a very beautiful woman.
Yeah, with a lot of forehead. You make her sound like a Klingon, Z.
Oh, that poor lady.
That was
or like Sid Haig in the Twilight Zone, right? When he's like the
I
big,
do think the way she
cranium.
Escaped from Bond's hotel room or leaves his hotel room with the – she ties this – is it Sari? Sorry. To the railing, and she just kind of tumbles over. Sorry. That was very cool. Very cool. And she's a very beautiful woman and, to me, the highlight of the female presence in the film with a lot of forehead. But the other thing that leads me to that stupid island that was Octopussy's Island or whatever. I'm sorry. With all those, was it a lesbian island? I don't know. But they're all wearing these weird, weird costumes. Speaking of a lot of forehead, how about a lot of camel toe? If you've not noticed, it's horrible.
So, okay. Let me address this in segments.
Please.
The forehead's there. The other thing is I thought this was kind of supposed to be like an Amazonian island, like Wonder Woman type stuff. That was my impression. I don't know about the thing you mentioned.
Yeah, I'd go with Frank on that.
You know,
liberated women.
Right. That was my, it was like, you know, that was my impression of what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be an empowerment.
Yeah.
You know,
I think Z's sitting there now, Frank, and he's saying these two are stretching.
No, bigger than
Christina Weyburn's forehead. You know,
I have an open mind, so I can see that point too. But it seemed to me, kind of, they were playing for the same team. A lot of them or all of them.
Jeez.
Yeah, I mean that could be. They could have been.
How about
been
the costume design? Though, let's go to the costume design.
It could have been
less. 10 seconds on that.
The costume design. Isn't memorable really for me. Okay. It's fine. Mac, here you go. Hot potato, bro.
No, it's India, you know. The saris are beautiful and so I think it's entirely appropriate for that. I was just trying to think of some of the other costumes in the movie obviously the safari suit in the jungle hunt, you know, where where we have the some of the biggest crimes that Octopussy commits during.
And
that
I don't even, you know what, I don't.
Most Dangerous Game.
I don't want to talk. Most Dangerous Game was a great concept, and it could have, if it was executed properly, would have been brilliant. But they just pissed it away, in my opinion.
Roger Moore's the clown.
I don't even want to talk about those moments because it could have been great, and it just really makes me sad. It makes me sad.
I don't think it's terrible though.
What? The Most Dangerous Game is a wonderful. I'm sure you've read it.
I've seen the movie.
It's a wonderful book, and it was really an excellent concept, but they didn't execute it.
It's a short segment in a James Bond movie.
Even so, they went for the laughs.
Yeah, and Frank, really, it does have some of the most egregious errors ever seen in any James Bond movie in the entire series. You can go right from the beginning where he scares the two guys out of the body sack and runs. And there's the sit to the tiger. There's the Tarzan yell. There's
the Tarzan yell.
Why?
Because it's fun.
Yeah, well, you probably get a kick out of the Ewoks doing it in Return of the Jedi.
Do. So there we go. We're drawing the line in the sand. Easy on the Ewoks.
During the commentary, John Glenn goes, he was talking about visual humor and that James Bond films are family films, and he went for a lot of humor. I'm total averse to that.
I agree with you. I agree with you, too. And I agree with you, and I don't like that John Glenn said that, and I don't view the Roger Moore movies as that way. Sure, I think they're family movies, but it's like a dad taking his, like, you know, I don't know how old the kid would be, like sixth grader or middle schooler, like, let's go see James Bond. That's cool, right? At least that's what I experienced. So anyway, what I like about it is it falls in line with the trend of the more films, for good or bad, they become very self-aware that they're not just movies, but they also start to incorporate stuff from other movies, if that makes sense. And I do like that. Sometimes I don't like it whatsoever. But I like that aspect of it. I mean, again, this isn't a moment in Octopussy where I think it's this, like, I'm going to watch the movie to hear the Tarzan yell. Well, I get a laugh. I get a snicker. I could do without it. My life would, and then I wouldn't feel any different about the movie if it wasn't in it. But I like that it's self-aware that, like, hey, it's a James Bond movie.
Frank, where do you stand on the use of the Monty Norman theme?
Exactly, it was my point. Yes, I was going to say that. It's like, you know, they did the same kind of thing in Honor Majesty's Secret Service where the janitor was whistling the tune of Goldfinger very briefly, a couple notes, but people in the know would recognize it. But why would James Bond recognize the Monty Norman James Bond theme?
And that's a good point. And that's something that I was going to bring up because that's something that I noticed last night. And it's because for the same reason that we get Tarzan or we get the Beach Boys song. And
did you hear my big sigh? Big sigh.
Right.
Big
but sigh. But this further laminates my point. And I mean, whether you like it or not, that's fine. But it's because these films become very self-aware of themselves. You know what I mean? They're no longer the spy movie, the danger, the excitement, like the thrills. Sure, these movies still have them, not as much as, say, you know, Goldfinger from Russia with Love, Dr. No. Like, those movies were fresh and new. And how do you keep something going?
I don't know. You just parody yourself? That's the answer?
But no. Well, yeah. I mean, that's what they started to do, right? And they still continue to do that to a certain degree, not as much with the Craig films, but, you know, Die Another Day, that's basically the whole movie.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
That's, you know, Mac's favorite. Maybe we'll invite him back for that one.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, Octopussy and Die Another Day. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
But you know what I mean? I think that's the phase it went through until, you know, Roger Moore's too old. You know, Pierce Brosnan, we can't get him right now. So we're going to get Timothy Dalton, and then they have to do something new with Timothy Dalton. You know what I mean? You can't use the same thing over and over again.
I agree, and it was a brilliant move to bring Dalton in. But I have to say this, too, and I want to talk about John Glenn. But why didn't they replace the director, too? Go ahead.
Yeah, because – okay, so I'm going to just, like, capstone the shit out of my TED Talk about how – the more films are so are culturally important because they're self-aware that they're movies. But, you know, I think a perfect amalgam is the alligator sequence.
Oh, God.
Is okay, because it's like Goldfinger, where he's coming through the lagoon with the duck on his head, right? But then it's also Live and Let Die when he runs across the alligator. So, I mean, that's what the Roger Moore movies are, man, and that's why I really like some of it.
I'm glad you brought up the crocodile boat, as John Glenn describes it as a boat in the commentary, and he said it'll get a huge laugh. And Roger Moore did not want to do it. He thought it was not a good idea, but he
good
did
for
it.
Roger Moore.
Yeah, I guess.
But I mean, good for him for being like, this is a stupid idea, but I'm going to do it because you're the director. But I don't agree with John. I like John Glenn. I think he's a great Bond director, especially when we get to License to Kill. But.
Okay.
No, I mean, I'm not with him with what you're saying. Right. I'm in agreement with you. Let me just put it that way.
A lot of his shots, even in this film, Octopussy, come across as very flat to me, very television like. Even the casino scene, it looks like a set. I don't know what the deal is. It doesn't look good to me. I don't think the Bond films ever looked worse than they did in the 1980s. And
come on. Really?
The 70s too were pretty bad.
Oh my God. So basically, okay. I feel like, okay, we're going to have to move from this subject because Mac, I'm sure you know what it's like if you listen to our podcast. I feel like Tom and I find our pivot points here where it's like, you know, he's going to be like, no. And then we feel slighted by the other because we feel like we're getting personal, because then my pivot point is like Die Another Day, man. That has some of the worst CGI, and I understand it comes from an era where the CGI didn't hold up, but even the shoddy CGI,
it was bad for the time. I agree.
But I mean, you know, I don't think there's anything like terrible looking or unimpressive about these movies. I think they all have a continuity of a look and an aesthetic.
I will say there's a couple scenes I really liked much better in this film than I had in the past. The Aerostar scene in the pre-title sequence is pretty well done.
Mm-hmm.
The airplane part of it, I didn't like the leering with the guards and such. And also when Orloff, and I think it's a nod to Von Ryan's Express, when Orloff is crazy training, he gets machine gunned down.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up that scene from Von Ryan's Express, and it's very, very similar.
So I never thought about that, but I imagine that's what it's an homage to.
So that was very cool. I like both of those scenes. I also think the best single sequence of a scene in the film is this is James Bond to me. Roger Moore on the balustrade with the machine gun, sliding down the balustrade as he's shooting. It's pretty cool. It was well done. That part was well done.
Yeah. Including shooting off the portion at the bottom, so he doesn't sort of suffer.
What about the train sequence? Yeah, I like a lot. I think the train sequence
is the fight along the top.
I think it's well done, and I think
it's all CGI.
But no,
CGI.
I hear a couple seconds.
Tell that to Martin Grace, shattered his hips.
But here's the thing about these movies, and I mean it's a testament to cinema at the time because I mean, other than like Tom Cruise, what actor is going to be on top of an actual moving train?
Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Jackie Chan. But anyway,
but that's what I mean. And the practicality of it. And I hate to be that guy because I love Star Wars and I love CGI and movies, but like, I don't want to sound like that guy, but there's something to be said about these films and the practicality of how they're made. And that's something I enjoy as I get older. Not only as I get older, but just as an aesthetic, there's something that is very inviting and maybe nostalgic about it. And it's like, man, this is how movies used to get made, right? It's like they couldn't make a computer train and everything, so they actually had to do all this shit, and there's people climbing all over.
And it did work. That is a highlight of the film as
plus
well.
I love his costume. I meant to mention that earlier when we were talking about costume design. The clown outfit, love it. This, when he's dressed like the twins, he's fighting him on the train, and he gets all pinned up. He gets all pinned up by the knives. Yeah. I love it. I think it's just so much fun.
The gorilla suit. Yeah, it's all good.
That the gorilla suit actually came from George MacDonald Fraser, believe it or not. In his book, he mentions writing the screenplay for Octopussy, and that
he
had to persuade Cubby to have that sequence, and I thought that must have been some Jedi mind trick to persuade Cubby to do that, because wow.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, that's not one of the highlights of that particular movie. Yeah.
George MacDonald Fraser. What else did he write?
Well, what did you think? What did
the
you
Flashman
think of...
novels. Oh. Yeah.
He wrote The Royal Flash?
He wrote The Face of His Novels, yeah.
Red Sonja? Nice. He's got a cool filmography.
What did you guys think of the score?
Not much about it.
It's pretty. And John Barry's a genius. Nice, and it's got a couple of very nice cues, but it's mostly forgettable to me.
Yeah, and I feel like the score tapers off with these movies.
And it's kind of pinned down by the theme tune as well.
Correct.
Yes.
It's like Live and Let Die, where it's like kind of that we're going to cue all the musical cues with some sort of theme.
Mm.
Which you did brilliantly, which Barry did brilliantly, I think, in Living Daylight's the next film. So.
Oh, yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Or not the next film, two films later, yes.
Even A View to a Kill, though, has a much better score. Yeah.
Correct.
God, that's such an interesting movie.
Which one?
A View to a Kill.
Yes.
Oh.
I was just
it's
talking
interesting
about
in so many
today.
Ways.
It is. There's so much about it that, like, I like, and then it's just, like, so much that's not great.
So they brought back a couple, you know, they brought back Peter Lamont. Like Barry, they brought back John Glenn. It was the old team pretty much on this one, which I always, you know, it was one of, they were all getting up in years. So I like that they were able to, I like to say that they were able to work together one of the final times.
Do you guys think that this might have been the film where
Roger Moore should have quit?
Where James Bond isn't as popular anymore?
Yeah, that's part of it.
Where it starts to kind of like slip out of the forefront of what's happening with cinema, and you know,
definitely,
what are the big events? You know, you got the Star Wars movies that ended, you got Indiana Jones, and then you know you have Octopussy and Never Say Never Again and A View to a Kill, and it's like it seems this is where they lose their relevance.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what they were afraid of. Their cultural relevance. Exactly. Firstly, I want to apologize for trying to finish your thought for you, Frank, seriously. But yeah, their cultural relevance.
And I agree. I agree with you. I agree with you it's like, hey, man, you, I don't know how many more of these we got with you. And, you know, you've been really good to us and we've been really successful with you. So we're not sure where to quit.
I think that's where you touched on it there, Frank. I think that's what happened. I think that the Bond movies kind of aged with Roger.
Yes, yes.
And,
that's a perfect way of putting it.
A View to a Kill is kind of like the point where you think you were great, but now's the time. Realistically, I suppose it could have been Octopussy, but...
But A View to a Kill has such a snapback. And what I mean by that is the things that they do to try and make it fresh and hip... completely showcase how old Roger Moore looks. I mean, from the theme song to,
it accentuates it, yeah.
Dude, to Grace Jones. Wow. Like, you imagine Grace Jones and like Pierce Brosnan or Grace Jones and Timothy Dalton.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be a fun couple. That would be fun to watch. And it's fine with Roger Moore because we've had all these movies before and he's James Bond, but like, man. And I think, Mac, you said it perfectly. These movies aged with Roger Moore.
Yep,
that's
a great point.
Perfect way of putting it.
But let's talk about View to a Kill next time.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I think, you know, to bring it back to Octopussy, I think that's something that is apparent with this movie. And you're right, Roger Moore's starting to look older. You know, For Your Eyes Only, but he's still awesome in For Your Eyes Only, and
he still looks young.
It's like prime Roger Moore, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, we get Octopussy, where it's like, okay, a lot of wrinkles, you're not moving around as much.
But an age-appropriate female lead.
Right.
You think?
Yeah, I do.
How old is Maude Adams in real life? I mean, relative to
Rose? I don't know, but she's not the young hot chick.
Yeah, well, that's
she's
a good point.
She's not Tanya Roberts.
I'll give you that. Okay.
She's not Brig Eklund.
She was born in 1945, so 18 years difference, actually, boys. So that's quite
but
a bit of difference.
But she's still older.
She carried it.
How old is Roger Moore? Oh, better be careful with this one, Tom.
In this film, he was
54.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. How old's Daniel Craig right now?
51.
Right. Yeah. How big of a difference? But yeah, I mean, no. Of course, we're in an age of where actors don't really age, and they haven't, you know, they stay physically fit forever.
Tom Cruise, unbelievable.
Tom Cruise is insane. Good for that guy.
What do you guys think about Desmond Llewellyn in this film as Q? Love the guy. Love the character. I think the Q scenes were really poorly done. And then him in the field, and then he's got some really bad lines, hot air, lands that balloon it on the island. And it's like, oh, my gosh.
Q doesn't get fun again until, like, License to Kill, and then he really gets fun with Pierce Brosnan.
I'll agree with you on that.
I think in the Moore years, there's not the same chemistry between him and Sean Connery or him and Pierce Brosnan. I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's a detraction, but I don't think it's as interesting or fun.
Okay, how about VJ? Did you guys find it strange that VJ was giving James Bond a massage? That's a little weird. Maybe there's another island. I don't know.
Oh, God.
I don't know where I'm going here today.
Yeah, I don't know where you're going with all the, you're just being very gender fluid with everything in our conversation. All right, let me bring up Old Boy that I always like to talk about for a couple minutes in the Moore films. One of my favorite, Gogol.
Yeah, I was going to mention it too. I know you love the guy. It's
I do.
I like the character. I like the actor. Absolutely.
Gogol's fun because it's like at the same time, it's like maybe the Russians don't really want to kill us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that's an interesting character to have at this time, you know, because Russia's the bad guy, geopolitical bad guy.
The thread with Gogol started, though, in 77, because there was obviously he was there and when Triple X teamed up with Bond. And Spy. But it went right the way through. And it's just a terrible shame that Walter Gotell's health prevented him actually playing, because he was supposed to play in Pushkin. The Living Daylight.
Well, they changed it to Pushkin.
They changed it to Pushkin, which would have been perfect, you know, would have worked brilliantly. It would have been a final great swan song
and an expanded role. You're right, absolutely.
Right.
A lot to do in that film if they would have written it the same way they did for Pushkin, right?
And it would which have was just, intended.
I like how they do the transition to the new Bond too. That's a perfect way, right? That's what they did with Judi Dench.
Yep.
It's just a smooth. It's like, hey, still the same timeline. We're good. See, she's in it. I think that would have been great if that would have happened. But I love him in it. I think he's fun. He's just an interesting dude to look at, too.
I agree, yes.
He has the face.
Lot of forehead.
Jowls.
I love his reaction at the end of For Your Eyes Only when Bond, you know, that's detente, you know, and he throws the ATAC over the side of the, and he's sort of like, what am I going to do with you? And he claps his hands like, what am I going to do with you?
he gives him a rub on the cheek.
You cheeky spy.
This struck me too when I watched the film, and I actually kind of enjoyed it. I'd like to know your thoughts. Is when Bond has got to get to the the army base because the bomb is there. And first off, there's a woman on the telephone in the telephone booth, and he's trying to contact whomever, and he couldn't get her off the phone. And then he starts running, and he some people were going to pick him up. He was like hitchhiking or whatever, not hitchhiking, but yeah, I guess he did hitchhike, and they stopped and then they teased him and they drove away. It's like, it was kind of frustrating. And I felt Bond's frustration at that point. And it was kind of an extended concept that they did, that he couldn't let people know that there was imminent danger, which was kind of cool. No, yeah, am I wrong? Tell me.
No, I like that. I like the build up to that sequence. I do. And also I'm with Frank on the clown suit. I know it's much maligned, but I think it works because Exactly, because of the clown suit. He's there in a clown suit trying to persuade people that there's a nuclear bomb, and you know, and they're looking at him thinking, you know, how can we take this guy seriously? Yeah, you're a clown. And right. You know,
the juxtaposition is, I agree, within a clown suit and there's a nuclear bomb right there. I get it. How many times has Bond deactivated a nuclear bomb in a series? I forget, but it's quite a bit. But I have a problem with the clown suit just because James Bond's in a clown suit. Because first of all, well, I'm not even getting.
Okay,
it.
Let me bring up. Okay, let me. All right, oh, so let me do a Let me do a whataboutism with Die Another Day.
Okay.
And James Bond, in a fucking Korean prison for 6 months, looking like Robinson Crusoe.
Yeah.
With the beard and the long hair.
I thought that was awesome.
No, see, I feel the way you feel about the clown suit was seeing James Bond like that, because it's just like, no, man, no.
Okay. No,
nope. That's all I'm gonna say. Let me bring all up right. Something that we can all probably talk about in a positive way is Robert Brown as M.
First time.
Right. So finally gets he
was
gets
minister
promoted.
Right a couple times.
He was admiral. Right.
Admiral. Yeah.
Admiral, Spy okay. Who Loved Me. Then we jumped. Yeah. We jumped For Your Eyes Only, and Moonraker. Right, because he's not in those.
No, that's dear old Bernard Lee, and it obviously, but he assumes the role of M in Octopussy for the first, because we have shouty James Villiers in For Your Eyes Only as Tanner, don't we? You know, who's,
Tanner.
Yeah.
What a thankless character throughout like the James Bond franchise.
No, he was good. I liked Roy Kinnear, is it?
Yeah. Okay. Roy okay. Kinnear, yeah. He's no, good. You're right. They redeemed Tanner with the Craig movies.
I actually like Kitchen. I thought Michael Kitchen was pretty good.
He did well.
Yeah. You
all
know.
Right, fine.
Where was the part? there was a scene that struck me. Bond has a gun in Octopussy, I'm speaking of, and he shoots a Russian in the head.
Yeah.
And it's like it was depicted very, you know, up close and personal. I thought that was strange. You usually don't when Bond shoots someone, he usually just falls over dead. You don't see the guy get shot in the head and blood spurting. It was kind of jarred me. You didn't catch? I mean, not.
Yeah, I do. It didn't. That's the train sequence, isn't it?
The train sequence.
Yeah, he's the soldier. Yeah, and he just turns around and shoots straight headshot. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Okay, I'm gonna go with my our semi traditional part of this film when Bond is trying to get to this army base where the circus is and where the atomic bomb is. He goes through the guard. He goes past the guard at the gate, and the guards gets on the radio and he's trying to warn his compatriots that Bond's, was he in a car? I forget now, but he's given a description. And at the last thing he says is, and he's wearing a red shirt. And that's exactly what he says. And he says, and he's wearing a red shirt. It's like, okay, there you go.
I live for the moments when you do this in our podcast, honestly, because like I never know what you're gonna do. I know
this
we talked
the,
about
the
it.
Line. Yeah.
And then I forgot that you were supposed to do it and didn't even know until you did it. And it's like, why the red shirt line, Tom?
Yeah, I don't know. It's brilliant. Oh, because it's so out of place, really. And it's not like he's wearing a red shirt. And he's wearing a red shirt. The delivery is unbelievable. It's very strange.
That's amazing.
What else you guys think about the film? I mean, is there any other points you'd like to touch?
Not really. Go ahead.
He should have shouted out. Oh no, I was going to say when he went through, he should have shouted out, he's in an Alfa Romeo, and it's not product placement at all.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it's that off-green I hate.
That off-green I hate.
It's fully loaded.
So we're going to wrap up, I think, speaking on Octopussy, lads. To me, it's. I'm going to rank it out of the 24. Well, I'm going to say 25, including Never Say Never Again. It's my second least favorite Bond film.
It's like I feel like every time we do a podcast, the Roger Moore movie we're talking about is your second to least favorite.
Have I said that? I don't think
I mean, I'm sure, but like, I just, it's how is this like, you know, as is worse than like, I won't even, I Die Another Day. I can't, because I know that you hold the torch for that one, which I like though, because I've been that guy multiple times. You got to defend the shit you like, stand up for it. I love that you do that with Die Another Day.
Okay.
But it's like, no, man. Second to worst James Bond movie is Octopussy.
I didn't say second. I said my second least favorite.
It's
Did I say worst?
It's the same thing.
Okay. Where would you rank it, Mac? I'm curious.
I'd rank it a bit higher than that, but not necessarily top tier. But I could definitely name probably four or five that I like.
Yeah, I could probably name 10 that I like.
More yeah.
This would go somewhere in the middle, lower middle.
Well, I think the rival Bond film of 83 is a superior film.
Absolutely
even though I watched it recently and it hasn't aged well.
Sure hasn't.
But it's a better Bond film.
And it's not a Bond film though, but that's fine.
Oh jeez.
I mean, I know that his name's James Bond and everything, and it's Sean Connery, but it's like
we're gonna talk about.
Could you even imagine? Yes, we are gonna speak about Never Say Never. Again, next podcast, absolutely. I look forward to a fresh rewatch of this movie. I mean, could you even imagine if, with Bond 25 coming out, if, like, Millennium Films that does the Expendables and, like, all that stuff, if they somehow were able to, like, use the license of James Bond and got Pierce Brosnan to come back as, like, James Bond in a remake of Thunderball?
That would be odd, I agree.
It would just be like, what? I mean, what was it like? What was it like at that time?
I think Connery was sticking his finger in Broccoli's eye a little bit too.
But I just mean, like, as a Bond fan, like, what was it like knowing that Sean Connery's coming back in, like, a non-sanctioned James Bond movie? I mean, were you excited? Were you, like, super excited?
I was very excited.
Okay.
I was extremely excited. Were you, Mac? Let me say this too. I've got a lot of English friends, and of the ones I know, most of them in England do not like Never Say Never Again. And then in America, it seems like it gets more of a pass. I'm actually surprised to hear, Frank, how much you dislike it.
Yeah, it's just like, I know we'll talk about it next podcast, but it's like, I don't want to say that it's like offensive, because that might be a bridge too far.
Yeah, that might be a bridge too far.
But
yeah.
I don't know. I just kind of feel like it's like the epitome of unnecessary.
What are your thoughts, Mac?
Yeah, Mac, what do you think?
It's deeply flawed, but it's based on work by Ian Fleming.
Exactly.
When you actually get around to watching it again, guys, all I can say is eyeliner. Hmm. Watch for Sean Connery's eyeliner.
That is a great. I never thought about that consciously, but as soon as you said it, all I can picture is like the bad tan and the salt and pepper wig and just like magic marker lines around his eyes. Because you're right.
I think you're right. I've never thought of it consciously either, but there is something weird about his eye line. So yeah.
But he's in better shape in that movie than he is in Diamonds.
Absolutely.
Easily.
And I mean, it's got Max von Sydow. It's got Bernie Casey.
It's got one of the best casts.
Brandau. Brandau is fantastic in that movie. Brandau,
won an Academy Award. She's good.
I agree. It's got a great cast. It's just like, no, man.
We'll talk about the
opening.
Yeah, it's not good.
But anyway, it's like it looks like a
light. We're going to wrap up Octopussy for this week. We want to talk a little bit about Bond 25, but again, we're going to talk about Never Say Never Again. Mac, you have been great. We'd love to have you back sometime if you'd be
able. Yes, please come back.
All
right, how about we do this? I don't think we have anybody scheduled to be a guest for any of the Brosnan movies. Am I correct, Tom?
I'd have to look at the schedule, but we'll talk, Mac. Okay. Do you have a preference? You let us know the preference after we do the podcast, and we'll, of course, if the audience will have them, we'll bring them back.
Okay. Thank you, audience, and thank you, Frank and Z.
Yeah, yeah. It's great.
No, this was a lot of fun, Mac. Your insight is awesome. Honestly.
Thank you very much, Frank.
I played you up a little bit, Mac, so thanks for following through. Thanks for coming through. go ahead.
No, I was just going to bite on following through, but I'm not going to go there. No, carry on.
No Time to Die. In a series rife with generic titles, this is perhaps the most egregious in terms of being generic. It's like, how many times can you put die in a title?
It's
the fourth time.
All right, so I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Keep going.
No, go ahead. No, no.
All right.
I, then You did hear about the 1957 film, right?
No.
We'll talk about that. Make your point and we'll talk about it.
Okay, so basically where I'm at with No Time to Die is I love it. And the reason I love it is part of the... Well, a big reason why I love Spectre is because, you know, like I said, I feel Spectre... Daniel Craig finally gets his James Bond movie. Like, he gets his James Bond movie, gets the gun barrel opening, gets the shit from Q. It's just like, you got the bad guy, and you got Blofeld, and then you got the henchman. It's like he finally gets his Bond movie, and I love No Time to Die as a Bond title. It may not be a contemporary Bond title. It may not be a contemporary Bond title, because we're used to the fancy, like Quantum of Solace and Skyfall and like this kind of stuff.
Well, those are Fleming influenced.
That's fine.
Or Penn.
And that's fine. And that's totally cool. I mean, we got Die Another Day. I like that title, even though I don't particularly care for the film. Live and Let Die. I love it. I like it. I like it.
I like Live and Let Die, and the
like.
The,
you only live. You
the
only
tradition
live twice.
Should have tied there, and the Tomorrow Never Dies. You know.
Right. It's like each Bond, aside from like poor Lazenby, and I guess. Well, I mean, you get Die in your title. That's a James Bond title. That's the way I look at it. Mac, save me.
What are your thoughts, Mac?
Come on.
I think the strangest thing was the rumored original title that came out was Shatterhand,
which I liked
because it's totally Fleming-esque. It is Fleming. It's Fleming. It's right out of Fleming. But there was obviously the belief that that gave the game away. And I don't know whether that was just, that was actually intended to be a title or it was a fan leak or whatever. But this particular one now, it's, initially, I thought, it's a bit uninspiring. But now, Aziz's going to mention to you, Frank, about the genesis of it and where it's actually coming from. It's kind of interesting and kind of cute and nice. So as far as the titles go, I can live with it. But I would have been all over Shatterhand.
It's not only Shatterhand is not only Fleming-esque, and it's right out of You Only Live Twice, the novel. But it also harkens, and I'm going to go back to the 60s because I'm fucking old, but it harkens back the great titles that are Fleming-esque of the early 60s films, Dr. No and Goldfinger. The film is named after the villain. I thought that would be perfect. I don't know if you think it's if they thought it was a tip of the hand. I'm hoping kind of that this No Time to Die announcement is kind of a goof and they're gonna retitle it, but that's probably not.
No Time to Die, I will say, feels like a retitle.
Yes, I agree.
It's like like whatever we're gonna do with Danny Boyle, we need to rename this project and we need to get it out there.
Well, here you go. I'm gonna give you this back. Go ahead. I cut you off.
No, I'm done.
I really was disappointed with the title when I first heard it, and as Mac mentioned, this spin on it that was announced, that not announced, but was discovered a day or two later, does put an interesting rotation on it. There was a 1958 film called No Time to Die, and in the U.S. it was called Tank Force. It starred, Victor Mature, Leo Getjen, and the director of the film was Terrence Young, who did the first three or four Bond films. It was produced by Warwick Productions. Warwick Productions was Albert Broccoli. So there was a film in 1958 titled No Time to Die. And how many years later is it? 60, 70 years? Whatever it is. 60 years later, Eon has decided to resurrect the title and slap it on a Bond film. So
that's cool.
That's intriguing. It's intriguing. And I understand the tip of the hat to their mentor, to the guy who started Eon Productions and so on. It was also this film, a couple other people were involved. It was written by Richard Maybaum and Terrence Young, directed by Terrence Young, Broccoli produced, Ted Moore did cinematography. There's a lot of Bond connections. So okay. obviously it's intentional. It's also Anthony Newley, who wrote Goldfinger, is in the film. So a lot of Bond connections.
Plus,
that is why.
Plus, I mean, it's Daniel Craig's last film. So,
well, maybe.
Hopefully not. But
it probably is.
It probably is, and I think that's an appropriate title for his last movie.
Yes. What are your thoughts? Are they going to we talk about this every podcast, Frank, but do you think it's going to be a continuation of or a nod to the Honor Majesty's Secret Service ending in the You Only Live Twice novel or not?
I don't know. The I don't want to. I know we've not talked about spoilers or like potential plot points, but I've read a little bit about a character that may or may not be brought back.
Go ahead.
So I've read about.
You want to say it? You want to say
so,
it?
So Tom and I, and I hope Batista comes back as Jaws. As you guys know, Tom and I, Mac, do you want me to tell you my story of why I think that's the case?
Let's do it. But if it's Dave Bautista back as Jaws, I don't know.
So it's Dave Bautista back as Jaws, because as you will remember in Spectre, the way he dies or exits the film is he gets the rope wrapped around his neck and one barrel, two barrel, three barrel go out of the train car and pull him out. And it's like, you know, Jaws pulls down one barrel, two barrel, three barrel. So that's my theory. Anyway, So Christoph Waltz, it's not officially confirmed, but word on the street is that he's coming back as Blofeld, which I certainly hope is the case, especially if this is going to be Daniel Craig's last film.
Absolutely agree. I can't see – how do they not bring him back if they have Leah Seydoux coming back?
Correct. And if it's going to be kind of how, you know, we think it might be trending with the Honor Majesty's Secret Service with, like, there's a snapback and something happens. And, I mean, did you – do you want me to tell you what I read about how he may be used in the plot, or do you consider that a spoiler, Tom?
What do you think, Mac? I'll leave it
to
Mac.
It's up to you. I mean, it's up to you.
Oh, thanks.
Go ahead. No, don't tell me. I don't want to know.
Okay, that's fair.
Thank you. Thank you.
No, that's fair.
No.
Absolutely.
I'll tell you. I went into Spectre not knowing as little about the film as I possibly could, and there was some surprises in the film that I know would have been ruined for me had I read everything or learned everything.
I feel like the trailer was kind of very overt about. You know, hey.
Oh, wait, I didn't even. You mean
the trailer for Spectre. I thought it was like, hey, they're brothers, quote unquote, and this is Blofeld. But so I won't say anything. But yeah, I mean, I do hope he comes back. I thought we both agree upon how he was underutilized. And I think a lot of things hinged upon the follow-up movie that Sam Mendes was supposed to do to Spectre. I think that really would have laminated Spectre with a lot of things that people don't like. I think there would have been a follow-through on. Mm-hmm. I hope that's going to be the case. I hope he's back. I mean, I think he was great.
He was great. He's a great actor.
Great.
Very underutilized. I hope he comes back.
I'm excited for Rami Malek.
We will see. Exactly. Maybe. Yes, agreed.
He's been officially announced. Yes, he has.
The Blofeld character has been portrayed on screen by some of the most eclectic but excellent actors in the history of cinema. Max von Sydow and Christoph Waltz, and then, you know, Donald Pleasence even.
Charles Gray.
But it's
Telly
fine.
Telly Savalas,
there you
Telly.
Go.
Telly's my favorite.
What an amazing!
He's actually my favorite too. I love Telly. I think he's amazing. Yeah,
he just gets so much to do. But anyway, yeah, I want to bring up. I know. Do you think that Rami Malek's going to be Blofeld because they recast the role, because they've always recast the role?
I hope.
In drag,
maybe Blofeld's son. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know.
I don't know. Do you think they would double down on another family connection to close out the Daniel Craig movie?
Oh, wow.
God, people's heads would pop.
Did you guys see, and I'm bringing this up because, Frank, I know you love this film and you interviewed at Eternity's Gate.
Willem Dafoe,
you interviewed him, and he's one of my favorite actors, and I'm sorry, Mr. Dafoe, that I forgot your name momentarily, but I loved the film. I love Van Gogh, first of all, but I just recently screened, great film, and you didn't tell me Mads Mikkelsen was in it, who's one of my favorite actors ever. He's wonderful, and he's great in this film. Have you seen that, Mac?
No, not yet. No, that's great. I haven't.
Put it in your queue.
That was one thing that I was like, I didn't know if you knew, and I wasn't going to say anything.
I didn't know until I saw him in the movie, and it's like, oh,
right,
my God.
Right. Mads is great. He's awesome. That's going to be a fun conversation for Casino Royale. But yeah, so Rami Malek, a couple other casting announcements. I would rather not address all the stuff about the black woman that's going to be James Bond.
It's actually kind of a brilliant in your face from Eon, I think they did it intentionally for all these people who are saying James Bond should be a woman. And not only did they do that, but she's also a minority. So it's brilliant.
Well, there's a huge misconception with, I think, what they're doing. I did not read as much as I might have should have to be well versed on the subject. But when I initially heard that and then kind of read the blurb, it sounded to me like she's the new 007 in the movie that goes to get James Bond and Blofeld kills her or something happens.
I didn't say James Bond, she's 007.
Right, and that's what I mean. And I think if that's the utilization, which it seems to be, what a perfect reflection of our cultural society of where we're at than to do that, and that's what James Bond does.
Yes.
I can almost see the reveal shot in my head now at the start of the movie, if that's the case.
That's going to be the opener. Going to be the opener, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about, I'm going to say, Bond 25. I'm looking forward to it. I haven't heard much about Cary Fukunaga, but I've been avoiding spoilers. So it's going to be a big April next year, right?
Yep.
Big one. Mm-hmm. And back to Mads Mikkelsen, I just got to mention this really quickly. Two things. The guy is excellent. I just saw a movie called Arctic. He's awesome. I recommend
it highly. That's on Amazon Prime.
He was in a really fun movie called Polar.
Mm-hmm.
See that too. He was awesome. He was great in Doctor Strange. I didn't know he was in Doctor Strange. And then I loved him in the Van Gogh film. So one of my favorites. The other thing I had to mention to you guys, because you probably have both seen it, I never had, was a film called Deadlier Than the Male from 1967.
No, oh, yes. I have not.
Elkie Summer. It's a James Bond spinoff, as it were. Elkie Summer is one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life, and I never realized it. Oh my God, I've seen.
Yeah,
her
that's
life.
Richard Johnson, isn't it?
Richard Johnson.
Yeah, he actually made two movies as that.
Hugh Drummond.
Bulldog Drummond. Yeah, right. Which of course was movies in the 30s made in Hollywood as well. It was a Sapper books by Sapper.
Right.
Yeah,
and Fleming and he had corresponded, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sapper, I believe.
Yeah,
they admired each other's work, but. Do you like that film, Mac? Because it reminded me. It's such a Bond film.
I love all those 60s Bond movies. I'm a big Eurospy movie fan, and I love all the movies that sort of tried to cash in. And then I've spoken to you before about the original OSS 117 movies, which actually predate Bond, predate Dr. No. So, yeah.
I even like the spoofs of...
The later ones, the most recent ones. Yeah, I love all those 60s movies,
Richard Johnson, who played Drummond in Deadlier Than the Male, I just learned this. Maybe you knew it, Mac, but Terrence Young wanted to cast him in Dr. No.
He was one of the ones. Yeah, and that's part of the reason why he's in that movie as well. And very good he is. He's a wonderful actor because people remember him from The Haunting,
Yes. Yes.
And also from, if you're so inclined as well, you also remember him from Lucio Fulci's Zombie.
Right.
But that's where I live. Okay. That's my world.
But Elka Summer?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
She's incredibly beautiful. Yeah.
She was actually from Rush with Love, so there you go.
Is Dahlia Lavi in it as well? Maybe she's in the other one, Some Girls Do, because I think that was the sequel to the Richard Johnson, to the Deadlier the Male. Some Girls Do was the follow-up.
Yeah, she's in it. She played Helga. So we're going to wrap up Octopussy. It's been a wonderful time discussing the film. Thank you for listening. Mac and Frank.
Remembered. Sylvia Cassina, and I didn't look that up. But anyway, yeah.
Sylvia Cassina.
Yeah, I'm just letting that go. She's in that movie. It's not Dahlia Lavi. Yeah.
No, Dahlia Lavi plays Helga in some.
She is in it as well. Okay. Oh, there you go.
I'm looking at it. Yeah.
Ah, you're cheating.
Well, yeah.
Well, yeah. That was perfect. Well, yeah. Why
so we're
going to
discuss Never Say Never Again.
That's almost like Roger Moore in the backgammon scene. It was amazing. Well, yeah.
Oh, God.
You guys have anything else to
No, I will say, I had fun with this conversation. Went places I didn't think it was going to go, and I love it. And Mac, it was a pleasure meeting you, and this was a lot of fun. I loved your insight, and please, you'll come back for another one. So we'll discuss it, and we'll figure it out which is which for that. But I am looking forward to moving forward and getting into Never Say Never, then A View to a Kill. Then this is going to be a lot of fun. So
it is. I've got one last thought, and then I'm signing off.
Okie dokie.
And he's wearing a red shirt.
I feel like I should do a remix of that quote and then the Octopussy theme, and that's going to be the intro to the podcast.
You want me to reloop it? I'll reloop it.
Oh my god!
It's not quite. There's an explode a button up in the control room.
Oh though. Yeah, do that one from You Only Live Twice. Next time Mac comes out, we're going to talk about our travels out west on Route 66, and
yeah, we didn't talk about that. Yes,
for a lot of time, Mac. We both did it for days. Say it, man.
Shouting it in a deserted street in Oklahoma. There's an exploder button up in the control room. We got to get up now.
From You Only Live Twice. And we just do it at random times. It was beautiful.
I love it.
So thank you, everyone.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you so much.